That Money Show with Gabriel Nussbaum on FUBAR Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to That Money Show. We are live on FUBAR Radio with me, Gabriel, That Money Guy. You should be used to that by now, but if not, it makes sense. That Money Show, That Money Guy. And we have one objective over the next hour or so. It's a simple one. I want to make you better with money. I've got like a great streak at the moment. We're like 75 weeks in a row worth of getting people better with their money. That number, by the way, fully made up. But it's an objective that I like to stick to. And how am I going to do that, I hear you ask? Well, we like to do a few things on this show. We like to play a bit of this and a bit of that. But in particular, I'll take a look at the news. I'll then going to kind of like filter it out for you and deliver you the actual relevant news that will affect the money in your pocket. I know, I do all the hard work for you. You're welcome. Actually, Kieran does, on another note. And then, of course, we like to bring in some incredible journalists, some expert, famous faces, just a range of guests to share their own advice and experiences on the topic of money so they don't just get bored by my voice for the next hour or so. We've got some really cool guests. In particular, we've got the global cyber security advisor, Mr. Jake Moore, and also a journalist, Emily Watkins, to talk about a very interesting story as to whether or not you would get out of bed for a job on less than 40k a year. There's context to it, guys. There's going to be context to the conversation, so do stick around for that one. So it's going to be fun. I like to answer your questions as well. I'm going to share with you some money tips. We've got it all in the show. We've got everything. But let's start at the beginning, because that's normally the best place to start, with what's happening in the news. And a few very interesting pieces of research have come to light. Honestly, I love these little surveys that come out. And this survey has studied that apparently one in four people are describing finances as uncomfortable. Now, I would like to speak to the three out of four people as part of that survey who lied. Because how are only 25% of people finding money uncomfortable? Like, I, you know, study this stuff. I talk about this stuff all the time. I still, to some element, find money uncomfortable. It's just part of British nature. But let's have a little bit of a deep dive into the study itself and kind of understand the ifs and the buts and maybe why people are lying about this kind of stuff. I'm not calling you a liar if you're part of the study. I am calling you a liar. But according to this research, it was commissioned by TSB Bank, if you've heard of them. They're pretty big. You might have heard of Lloyds TSB. They broke up. It was a while ago. They're over it. But it says that 23% of people in the UK describe their financial situation as uncomfortable, and around 32% say they don't feel confident about their financial outlook over the next 6 months. Now, there's always this kind of range of studies that are done around this kind of thing. And typically, it's just this idea that around the topic of money, people are uncomfortable, you know, talking about it. They're uncomfortable thinking about it. They would just rather ignore the problem. And what this show is trying to do is flip the script, because natively, like I said, we don't like talking about this stuff. So instead, let's just listen. Let's just have a chat about it. Listen to this show. See if this is kind of that first step towards you getting a little bit more comfortable with the topic of money. I'm not saying this is going to sort every one of your money problems, but it's a great first step. But this study went a little bit further. So what we're looking at here in particular is that apparently around 2/5 of people, 42%, are expecting their spending to increase in the coming half year. Obviously, those biggest things are going to be things like utility bills, groceries, holidays. It then took a bit of a look at subscriptions. And apparently, this is big, by the way, 61% of people have at least one ongoing subscription. That's not the big part. I would thought it'd be like 100% of people have subscriptions, with an average spend of £61. So if you're sitting there already thinking to yourself, well, I subscribe to just like Netflix, that's it. That's like £5-10 a month. Well, you're on about £61. I would probably say it's time to check your bank statements, because subscriptions are one of the biggest traps to money flowing out of your wallet without you noticing. I know people that have had a check of their bank account over the past month. It's the first time they've ever done it, and they've noticed they're paying double subscriptions, which means they're paying two subscriptions for the same thing. They forgot to cancel subscriptions that they did, like a, you know, you do like that little free trial for like 2 weeks and you're like, I'll definitely remember to cancel it. Yeah, it's been 2 years since then. It's probably time to actually go and cancel it. You don't use it anymore. 17% of people admit that they've never reviewed or cancelled any of their subscriptions. Yeah, if you are part of that 17%, please go and check your bank account. Like, just go and check the money. I'm probably going to save you like £50 right now, because subscriptions are the banes of people's life in terms of the fact that they're just so easy for you to spend a little bit of extra money on. Little things here, guys, the little things. And then when it comes to kind of budgeting and money management, we've got Over half of people saying you do not have a budget in place. If you don't have a budget, you don't know how much you're spending. If you don't know how much you're spending, you're spending too much. That's just like a simple chain reaction right there. So if you are, again, part of half the people that don't have a budget, it might be time. There's lots of apps out there that will do all the hard work for you guys. They're free. Go and have a look. Talking about money, like what I'm doing right now, 57% of people say they do not talk openly about finances with friends and family. If you don't want to talk about finances with friends and family, there's a lot of charities, by the way, especially if you're having problems. So again, let's not have the excuse of like, you don't want to be judged. Go to someone that you don't know, use the charity and online services and have those conversations, especially if you are struggling. And if you're not struggling, just start opening up, because this is the right time to do it. Don't wait until you are struggling to start to have money conversations. It gets a lot harder down the line. And then it does get a little bit more struggling because the amount of people that are missing savings on utilities, 14% of people say they never check for better deals on services like energy, broadband or utilities. And 38% of bill payers admit they've never switched providers to a more competitive option. So here's the deal, guys. Again, if you are part of that percentage that don't check for better deals on all these kind of subscriptions, services, you're also not allowed to complain about, well, no, you are allowed to complain about things being too expensive. But like, it's a bit like complaining before you've done any work. So if you can go out and save a bit of that money, maybe you shouldn't be allowed to complain until you've at least, you know, go and like compare the market, money saving supermarket, you switch. There's so many companies that do the work for you guys. So when it comes to saving a little bit extra every single month, put in the work, because the work actually isn't that much. Okay, what's going on elsewise in the news? This is a very interesting one. So listen up if you struggle to save, full stop, because more than 500,000 people, extra people, are now in lines for a little bit of a savings boost since the UK government have announced a major expansion to their Help to Save scheme. So you might not have heard of this before, and if you haven't heard of it and it applies to you, I'm about to sort you guys out with a bit of extra free money. So what is this scheme and how does it work? So this whole idea is that if you can save somewhere between £1 and £50 every single month, and the government are going to add 50p for every £1 you save. So if you save that full £50, you're adding on £25 worth of free money every single month. So to give you kind of some context, over 4 years, someone saving the maximum £2,500, they are putting an extra £1,200 into their bank for free. These bonuses are normally paid out, by the way, at the end of years two and four, based on the kind of the highest balance that you have saved. Now, you might be thinking to yourself, that sounds great. I could do with an extra 50p for every £1 that I save. That would definitely get me saving. You need to know who this is actually for. So not everyone is applicable for this. 550,000 more people are now eligible because the scheme has been extended to all people with working universal credit claimants. Okay, so anyone who is a working universal credit claimant, time to go for it. It's part of the government's wider plan for change to grow the economy, support households, all that kind of stuff. And it takes about 5 minutes to set up an account. You can literally do it all through the gov.uk, through gov.uk or the HMRC app. Just to kind of let you know roughly how incredible this is, 93% of participants are currently saving the full £50 a month, which shows you these are the people, again, on benefits and kind of the universal credit claimants. So these are people who are really struggling. This plan, this Help to Save plan, pushes people to actually start saving. So if you can use this as the incentive to start putting a bit of money towards future you, please, please, please use it. I know that it's not easy for everyone, but that incentive, you know, 50% extra money towards on top of your savings, that is huge. I could not think of another way in life where you can kind of guarantee that extra bonus into your savings. So do not sleep on this. If you are applicable to the Help to Save, it's called the Help to Save scheme. A quick Google will allow you to find it. It's been available since 2018. The government's paid out millions on this alone. And in 2024 alone, nearly 18,500 people opened an account. So go check it out, see if you're applicable, and then go and open it and start saving. We're trying to come up with clever ways and incentives for you guys to save, make it easier for you to save. Remember, £1 becomes £1.50, £5 becomes £7.50, £10 becomes £15, £50 becomes £75 a month. That is the difference between literally zero and saving for a potentially much, 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 what's the word? Kind of more comfortable future. Important, guys. And last but not least, one in seven of people that were surveyed, it's not everyone in the entire world, but across all different age groups, would rather cut their long-term savings than give up on certain lifestyle expenses. So I'm going to set a bit of context for you guys here. You might have heard of things called like the 50-30-20 rule, the 60-20-20 rule, the 60-30-10 rule, the whatever. Different percentages. But essentially what it does is it buckets the amount you spend into three different categories. We've got needs, we've got wants, and we've got savings. Savings, very understandable. Saving towards any kind of goal, long-term, short-term, tomorrow, yesterday, probably not yesterday, but you get the picture. Now, the line between needs and wants has started to get more blurry. Typically, needs were very kind of, it was black and white between needs and wants. Needs are things you need to survive. Wants are things that you'd like to have. It make your life a little bit nicer. So needs, rent, mortgage, bills, groceries, anything to do kind of with, I suppose, like health services, prescriptions. You know what I'm talking about. Wants, going out for drinks with your mates, going to the cinema, buying yourself some clothes, etc., etc. Apparently, this is starting to change. So, this was a study of 18 to 24-year-olds who have looked at their top essentials. These are the needs, the things that they have to pay for. 30% said that socializing is now an unavoidable expense. 27% say a gym membership is essential. 25% say they cannot go without streaming services like Netflix or Spotify. 25% include new clothes on the lists of needs. And 22% say skincare and beauty treatments are basic living requirements. Now, I can probably hear like the divide between different age demographics, half saying, "Are you crazy? How on earth are those things needs?" Whereas the 18 to 24-year-olds are probably going, "Yeah, no, I can see that. Yeah, gym membership probably is a need nowadays." I will clarify this based on kind of my own opinion, which is if you're paying for Third Space membership or David Lloyd's membership, I'm probably going to argue that might not be a need. If I can understand the gym side. Health is wealth. Health is everything. Health is the pillar that everything else rests upon. So if you're paying £300 a month to go to Third Space and claiming that as a need, you have to spend that every single month, but you're struggling to save, maybe it's time to look at the gym group or Pure Gym or Anytime Fitness. You know, there are places that call themselves gyms that charge 10% of the price you're currently paying at Third Space. So this is kind of the split between where I agree and disagree. I'm fine if you need a gym. A gym is kind of the thing that gets you to do exercise, very important, and you want to put that into your needs. It just depends on which gym you're currently going to. Very quickly, it can become a want. So you can kind of see this broadening definition of the ideas of what is essential versus what is not essential is changing incredibly quickly. And I would love if you do want to DM us on at That Money Show and just give us a list of things that probably used to be wants are now becoming needs for you, including things like socializing, the gym memberships, the beauty things. I'd love to know in particular what you are starting to believe is kind of changing that threshold, because I think for the younger generation it's becoming very different. Again, here, 30% of 25 to 34-year-olds are saying that investing in physical health is a non-negotiable. I'm all for that. Like I said, it just depends on how you're investing on it. Remember, guys, it is... I was going to say it's free to run. It's kind of free to run. You do need to buy trainers, but it's free to run. Anyway, that's all for what's going on in the economy. Stick around, because after this, I'm going to be joined by the Global Cybersecurity Advisor, Jake Moore.
FUBAR Radio.
Death, a funny business on FUBAR Radio with Becky Briggs and Natasha Spencer-Levy.
We store so much of our trauma and our energy in our body. I am just incredibly, incredibly tired of keeping this trauma locked inside my body. And so all I needed to do is release it. You know, it's like going on a bender and drinking too much booze and you throw it up because you just need to get that out of your system, because it's gonna catch up with you at some point if you don't.
You're listening to FUBAR Radio. Download our app now to listen to your favourite shows, such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored, and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all FUBAR shows, including our box sets. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app. Just search for FUBAR Radio on the Apple and Google App Stores. Yay! The FUBAR Radio app. Get it today. Get it today.
It was calm on the beach, so I took my little girl out on the water. Then we hit the wind, and it blew us out to sea, faster than we could paddle back. And we learned our lesson from these guys, the crew who got us home. Thank you.
Respect the water and watch out for the winds. In an emergency, call 999 and ask for the Coast Guard.
If you drink a little, then drive, you risk losing your license. You risk every day becoming more complicated.
How am I supposed to get to training, Dad? How am I supposed to...
You risk losing your job.
I'm going to have to let you go.
You risk your family not looking at you the same way.
I can't believe you did that.
You risk injuring someone.
Hello, I need an ambulance.
You risk being seen as a drink driver. Drink a little, risk a lot. Think.
Access all areas with Bobby Norris.
We are joined by Miss Safia. If I could produce you a salt, what is he like on paper? Sound like we're on Love Island.
Okay, on paper, my type has to have a good soul, good purpose and calm energy. I'm in my energy era where you've just got to come in and make me happy. I don't need you for anything. I want to find happiness and I need him to be kind.
What the Hell with Georges Bertineau on FUBAR Radio.
Up now is Ephraim Mason-Clark, professional footballer. You got the chance to work under Frank Lampard. Just tell me a little bit about him.
The first day he came in, it was just like, the word isn't starstruck, but it's just like, this is a legend in not just English football, but football in the whole world. So at the start, it was more of like, wow. And then it's like, you just switch off from being a fan to, this is like the gaffer now.
That Money Show on FUBAR Radio with Gabriel Nussbaum.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to That Money Show. We are live on FUBAR Radio with me, Gabriel, That Money Guy, and I'm not alone on the show now because I am going to be joined by Global Cybersecurity Advisor Jake Moore to talk about just a rising problem. I'll give you one example on what problem I'm going to be discussing. When an article came out a few weeks ago, I think, about one Oasis fan who lost £1,700 to a ticket scam for the band's reunion tour. And this is becoming a little bit of a worrying trend. So, Jake, you are here to help me understand this crazy world of ticket scams, staying safe online, because it seems to be a problem that isn't just not going away, but seems to be becoming more complex and increasing in quantity. So, should we kick off with a bit of an introduction to who you are and kind of how you interact with the world of ticket scams, hopefully from the good guy side?
Hi, yeah, well, thanks for having me. So, yeah, I'm always doing research into cybercrime, and time again, these scams come up because scammers are, well, they're getting so much better at duping people, manipulating them into giving away their money. We hear the stories all the time when we think, how is anyone so silly to give away their money? But the fact is, they're so good at making people believe they are real or using, say, newer technology to make them believe that. Unfortunately, too many people are getting sucked in.
They are indeed. So what's the state of the world currently? How are we looking at it globally? Are you seeing a rise? Is it a scary rise? And how bad is it getting? Who is being duped here?
Yeah, so these high demand shows, if you think of something like Taylor Swift last year, and like you say, Oasis this year, even Coldplay, they just attract scammers because, well, the whole world wanted Taylor Swift tickets, it seemed, last year. And again, in the UK, we've got so many fans wanting Oasis tickets that scammers are just going to be hanging around the internet, working out how to best make their money. And these are organized crime gangs that we've found. So they are able to sell multiple tickets in fraudulent names. We hear of identity theft all the time. They're very good at using all sorts of fraudulent, so fake identities. And if these ticket sites are able to pay them within 48 hours without the buyer making any sort of complaint, then they're able to pull the account and then start another one, brand new account in another fraudulent name. And therefore, they're just making the most out of this system.
Yeah, and the numbers are very scary. Lloyd Bank Group are currently estimating that over £2 million has been lost to Oasis tickets alone. I'm not just picking on Oasis, but that's probably the biggest concert coming up this year, so where a lot of the data is coming from. And if you think it's like a little bit here, a little bit there, it isn't. The average current scam being amount being lost in this scam, £436 per person, which is well above the retail price, of course, of the price that they were selling at. There was the whole issue, I remember, back when they released them about the tiered pricing and how they did shoot up. We're not talking about that anymore. We're talking about fake tickets, tickets that do not exist. You do not receive the ticket. You lose the money and you do not get to go to the concert. So having said that, what are these red flags? Because if we're losing £2 million worth of money to scams alone, There must be things that we can look out for because they have to be all around us.
Yeah, that's right. And I think we just need to remember we've got to be buying from the official channels. So the box office or any links from the genuine website, and therefore avoid social media. But I know what it's like. You desperately want a ticket. And then within a few minutes or maybe an hour or so, the tickets are gone. And so you desperately start looking elsewhere. And that's where these criminals are so good at getting desperate people who want the tickets for themselves or to give it to a loved one. And so, yes, avoid social media and other sites that you haven't heard of. And then if anyone's offering you screenshots, a big no-no. What we have seen is with screenshots, say barcodes, so say old-fashioned barcodes now, like an old-fashioned, say, static QR code that doesn't move, those ones can be sold again and again. And therefore, the first person gets in with it, then other people who say have that screenshot will just get denied entry. So if you have to buy these new barcodes, make sure it's a dynamic barcode. That's the ones that are moving around. You tend to see these with Ticketmaster. They sell these officially transferred tickets. So say you buy one from Ticketmaster, you can't go. You want to sell it to someone else. You can go back to the official channel and then it gets sold on to someone else. And that's using the Apple and Google Wallet, which is brilliant. You know, most people are starting to get used to using NFC in their wallets, digital wallets. But I do think maybe the older generations just aren't liking this technology. Maybe that's why they're picking on Oasis, because the people just don't trust it as much. They want a physical ticket. And of course, that's where these criminals are just going to pounce.
I can see the problem for sure. And I like this general recommendation. If it's a screenshot, if it's anything like that, these can be manipulated so easily. This isn't the hard scams anymore. We're not talking complex scams. To just have a fake picture for proof and things like that can take, you know, someone scamming online seconds, especially with the rise of, you know, AI to just change a few things on a picture here or there. Like, I mean, just have a quick look at the recent trends on what people are using images for, using things like ChatGPT, which is relatively available to pretty much any person. And you realize just how easy it is to do complex things. So, yeah, official channels, I like that. If a friend or someone you know is offering you a ticket, is that kind of time to lower your guard a little bit if you do know the person? I'm assuming someone can also always scam someone and delete them as a contact and whatever it is. But is that, I suppose, a slightly different environment?
It may be, but I would still ask them where they got it from, just so you can just have a general chat about making sure they didn't get scammed. Because no one wants to turn up on the big night of an event and find out that they're not going in to the venue. That would be just horrendous. So make sure you find out where they've got it from. But yeah, if it's coming through NFC tickets, so these digital wallet tickets, then you can let your guard down and you can trust it, especially if you can prove that they're not going to get the tickets, say, near at the time. You need to, say, log in with them. It's good to just chat about how they got them. But if they start saying, oh no, a friend of a friend got them, or she's definitely close to the artist, or something that doesn't just seem or sound right, then I would just steer clear of it until you've got everything in a row.
Yeah. Okay. Let's switch lanes for a second to the people that have been scammed, which there are numerous. There might be people listening to this thinking they've got, you know, they might now be realizing that they've fallen for a scam because someone was going to send them something in the post over the next few weeks. And that's often something that someone will do. They'll say, you know, here's a picture, we'll send it over to you, but we need the money up front. They've given you proof of the picture. Very likely to have been a scam. So once you have realized, what are the kind of immediate steps that you should be taking to kind of protect yourself or rectify that situation?
Yeah, so it does depend on how you bought the tickets. So if it's cash or a bank transfer, you haven't really got too much in terms of getting your money back. That's going to be difficult. If you've paid with PayPal or a credit card over £100, then you do have some sort of agreement to potentially be reimbursed, but you've got to act quick. If you bought the tickets through Viagogo, then you need to be acting very fast. So say you bought the tickets, you get to the event and you find out you have been scammed, act straight away that night or the next morning. Make sure you get onto Viagogo, because what they do is they keep the money in escrow. So they hold on to that money for that 48 hours. If no one complains, like I said, the scammer's going to just get that money into their account and shoot off with it. But if you can say, no, it definitely didn't work out, you can then be or see the money hopefully come back to you because they're just holding it for you. But it's all about speed here. So if you can make a big song and dance out of it, maybe even speak to your bank. I love it when people go to social media and say, my bank were rubbish. They didn't reimburse me. They hate seeing that on their socials. So if you can get on there, you've got more likelihood of getting that money back.
Speak to as many people as possible, as quickly as possible, seems to be the thing. Don't do nothing. Don't just be like, oh, I've been scammed out of 436 quid. I'm just going to sit back and relax. No, you can do something. And even if the answer ends up being no, at least you know that you've given it kind of your best efforts. And I like that. Speed is important because you just have to put yourself in the shoes of the person or the platform that's providing you the ticket. If you've bought a ticket and it's been 6 months since you attended that show and all of a sudden you go, oh, I didn't actually get into that show, they're going to be like, what do you mean you didn't get into that show? Like, it's 6 months since then. So you can start to understand how speed starts to work in your favour here. Don't worry, it doesn't have to be at the moment you don't enter the show. I know that, like, especially around concerts and arenas, connectivity is going to be poor. You're probably going to struggle and all that kind of stuff. 24 hours, 48 hours is probably fine, hopefully, depending on the website's terms and conditions. How do we start preventing these scams happening in the first place? I mean, you are in the world of cybersecurity. Cybersecurity is obviously becoming more and more complex itself to adapt to all of these challenges. But is it an issue of technology or is it an issue of regulation, laws? What's the issue here and how can we start to fix things?
Yeah, great question. This is actually the biggest problem we find because just as we've, say, got rid of one problem, we just see the expansion of AI and just throwing out even more sophisticated crimes for all through scams on the public like this to huge cyber crime on businesses where, for example, like Marks and Spencer's in the last just week where they were knocked offline with contactless payments. The things are growing so quickly. So right now it's about people being more aware of what they're doing. So if we talk about ticket scams, it's really about knowing to question things and making sure that you don't just take it on, say, face value or acting in desperation, because that's what they're going to pick on. Just like your classic phishing email, for the last, say, 10 years we're still seeing these phishing emails that are coming through where they're making you act very, very quickly. And that's exactly the same, say, psychology that works with these ticket scams, because people want to act quick. Otherwise, say, the buyer might be saying, well, if you don't take it, these four tickets are going to go to someone else, and I know someone else wants them. So act now and give me all your money. It's all down to that. However much regulation you put into it, criminals don't care. However much efforts you put into stopping a simple scam like this, it's so easy to bypass. So it comes back down to people being aware of it, because the onus, unfortunately, is on us. Mm-hmm. Hopefully, if you do lose any money, the banks will reimburse. But to stop that even occurring, make sure you do a double take. If it's too good to be true, it usually is. And always try and verify anything such as the authenticity of a ticket where you can.
I think that's a great final piece of advice. Well, thank you very much for joining us on That Money Show. And hopefully everyone listening to this going forward will never be scammed ever again. I think that's the policy here.
Been great.
Thank you. Well, there you go. That was everything you need to know about the world of scams from an expert in the world. I think my kind of key takeaway was the onus, I'm afraid, is a little bit on you guys. Whilst banks and government and laws are trying their best to keep up, ultimately a lot of this is just social engineering. They're trying to trick you as a person. So be aware, be vigilant, and try and use the correct channels, people. Cool. So time for Money Tip of the Week, where I give you something short, something practical for you to take away at the end of the show. So you're officially better with money. I like it. It sounds like a good deal. 2 minutes of ear time for a lifetime of improvement with finances. Great trade from me. And what I would like to make you aware of is the changes to the national living wages and the national minimum wages. Because ultimately, even though these changes have happened, your employer might not have actually implemented it into your paycheck. So your salary might not be showing that. You should or could be owed more money. And I'm going to tell you about the current updated rates that should affect everyone. I don't care if you're a temporary, part-time, zero-hour contractor. These are the minimum kind of amounts that you should have been being paid as of April 1st, by the way. This isn't coming in. This is coming already. So it should be in your April paycheck already. So if you are age 21 or above, the changes to the national living wage have been £11.44 up to £12.21. If you're aged 18 to 20, that number goes from £8.60 up to £10. That's the national minimum wage. And if you are 16, 17 or an apprentice, it's going from £6.40 to £7.55. So I'm going to go through those numbers one last time. £11.44 to £12.21 if you are 21 or over, £8.60 up to £10 if you're 18 to 20, and £6.40 up to £7.55 if you are 16, 17 or an apprentice. These are official changes as of the 1st of April, so they should be in your next or current paycheck. And if they haven't happened, tell your employer. It's the law. They cannot deny you this. And also, if you've left the job and you weren't paid fairly, you can report old employers if they weren't paying you correctly through the government website. So yeah, guys, make sure that you are getting paid the amount that you actually deserve. And it's a nice little money tip of the week for those of you that are currently earning the national living or the national minimum wage. You just got a pay rise. Congratulations. Anyway, guys, stick around, because after this very short break, I'm going to be joined by Emily Watkins.
FUBAR Radio. Pulse of the Nation with Andrew White on FUBAR Radio.
Are you aware of the tea alarm?
Tell me more.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's this cultural phenomenon that we have in Britain. It's an alarm at 3 p.m. Where everybody in the UK has to have a cup of tea, and if you miss it by a certain number of minutes, you get fined, basically.
This ain't real. This is not real. I'm not playing into this. Yeah. You think me watching Keeping Up Appearances, you think Mrs. Bouquet was missing a 3 o'clock tea alarm? Y'all won't get me.
You're listening to FUBAR Radio.
Download our app now to listen to your favourite shows, such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all FUBAR shows, including our box sets. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app.
Just search for FUBAR Radio on the Apple and Google App Stores.
Yay! The FUBAR Radio app. Get it today.
Get it today.
Registering to vote means you can take part in the way decisions are made in the UK. When you register to vote, you are then able to cast your vote at local and national elections. You can help choose who runs your area and makes decisions about things you care about. Millions of people in the UK aren't registered to vote, and they miss out on having their voice heard. It's quick and easy to register. It only takes 5 minutes. You can do it online, or you can ask for a paper form at your local council. Register to vote now at gov.uk/register to vote.
Is the sound of your mates alive? Is getting to more gigs this year and the next? Is the sound of saying, I got you, mate? Is the sound of mates enjoying even more of this? Is the sound of mates getting home instead of here? Click your seatbelt, because you're twice as likely to be killed or seriously injured if you don't think.
Couple Goals with Sophie Kasai and Jordan Brooke.
When I've met people in the past, I'm like, oh yeah, I really love him, he's the one. But I just knew they weren't. I'd say it, but I knew I didn't mean it. But when I met you, there was a different feeling. Like, it's like your gut just tells you. When people used to say, when you know, I was like, oh, piss off. But when you know, you know.
When I met you and times got hard, I would come up with a strategy to make it better.
Death, a funny business on FUBAR Radio with Becky Briggs and Natasha Spencer-Levy.
So we've got Dr. Matt Morgan. Someone's heart stopped beating for 8 hours.
So he was stuck on a ledge in a freezing snowstorm, and his heart stopped for an amazing 9 hours. He's still the world's longest surviving cardiac arrest patient. And he lived because he was cold. You know, there's a saying, you're not dead until you're warm and dead.
That Money Show on FUBAR Radio with Gabriel Nussbaum.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to That Money Show. We are live on FUBAR Radio with me, Gabriel, That Money Guy, and I'm not alone yet again, which is great. So you didn't just hear my voice for the entire hour. I'm being joined right now by Emily Watkins.
Hi.
Who's going to talk to us about, would you say, controversial argument? Maybe not controversial, a little bit?
I think it gets a real reaction out of people. The idea being that Gen Z are saying they don't want to get out of bed for less than £40,000 a year makes people very cross.
Yes, I assume people that would get out of bed for £40,000 a year, or older generations that did get out of bed for a lot less than £40,000.
That's right. Yes, it's very tempting to say, in my day,
yes,
we earned this much, but a lot has changed.
I mean, I suppose the whole argument has come down to the rapid increase in the cost of living, where young people are finding it harder and harder to survive on, well, I suppose, what are national living wages, which have just gone up. But I think if you look at a full-time employee, it's going to be around 24-ish thousand, 23-ish thousand pounds a year.
Yeah.
Got to run the numbers myself. But now this kind of younger generation is saying, well, that's great, that's the living wage. It's not accurate. £40,000 and above is kind of where it becomes worth it.
Yeah, I think for a long time, like an entry level job paid a wage that meant you could be independent, leave home as a starting point, which a lot of young people today just aren't able to afford. And, you know, not live like a king, but, you know, go for dinner, save up for a holiday. And that's what generations before have really taken for granted. And I think it's fair enough, right? If you're working full time, it's not unreasonable. But yeah, cost of living, even since I was in my early 20s, the average rent in the UK has doubled, which is kind of staggering. It's only 10 years. But, you know, I was able to rent a little studio flat or half of one with someone else. On 18 grand a year, I remember. And it just isn't possible now.
No, it quite literally kind is impossible, especially, I suppose, when you start to look like places like London.
Yes.
If you're listening to this from further north or outside of the London, like kind of metropolitan area, you might be thinking to yourself, £40,000 is loads.
Sure.
I could easily argue that, but I suppose you've got to understand that London is the capital. It's where most people in the country are. I say most, I mean, it's the biggest city in the country by far. And when you're starting to look at average rent prices of probably almost £1,000 per person or going upwards for a very, you know, nice or simple accommodation, not too far into central London. £1,000 isn't an unreasonable amount. Again, sorry to say, if you're living on your own, probably even more than that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Then you're looking at, you know, plus bills, plus groceries,
plus
the needs that I said earlier, going to the gym and trying to have a little bit of a social life and also trying to save for your future self.
Yeah.
That's where the number £40,000, I suppose, starts to become a little bit less unreasonable when you're looking at the maths.
Yeah, definitely. I think, it's soundbitey and it makes, you know, it makes people cross, but you know, the monthly take home on if you're on 40k is something like 2600, and the average rent in the UK is 1300, so half of it's already gone on your rent. I mean, I know it's, as you say, it's not the same up and down the country, but there are a lot of people in house shares in big cities paying £1,000 for a room, you know.
Absolutely. So when we justify it like that and we're starting to give the numbers to explain why it doesn't sound so unreasonable, why are people getting so upset by this statement, which was, by the way, it was said by Graham Cowley in the House of Lords. And I suppose taken in isolation, it's left people fuming.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of in my day, you know, and, you know, £40,000 would have been an enormous amount if you got your first job in 1990, understandably. I think it's easier to get cross with young people than it is to think carefully about some really dire and like structural problems that they're facing. That's much more challenging, I think, for people. It's easy to get angry, but actually not so helpful.
Yeah, I feel like this is kind of bringing me back in my mind to a video I watched interviewing older generations' attitudes toward younger people. And someone was like, well, if they stop spending so much money on avocados, they might be able to afford a house.
And how many avocados is that?
It's a lot of avocados. and if avocados cost 20 grand a pop, which they don't last time I checked. So that's kind of, I suppose, where the anger is coming from. But it also has to be coming from some position of logic, because like we said, the national living wage is almost half of that £40,000. So some people clearly are surviving and are living on a lower salary. So when someone tells you, well, I'm not getting out of bed for less than 40k, what's driving, I suppose, the mindset towards that 40k number? Like, is it just entitlement? Is it a little bit of laziness? Is it because people just want to have nicer things in life these days and feel like they deserve more? Are there things that kind of do kind of push that other side of the argument?
I think it's important to note that this is like someone quoting someone. This is Graham Cowley quoting his colleague in something that he's delivering to the Lord. So this isn't like no one's done a poll of Gen Zs who are, and they're all saying I won't get out of bed. In fact, I don't recognise it, to be honest. You know, younger friends, it's not, this is caricature, I don't recognise. So I think that's important. It's not like that this is what people are actually saying, but the sentiment chimes with a lot of the stereotypes about younger people. I don't think, though, that it should be a problem for people to ask for wages that let them have a sort of pretty basic level of independence and comfort. You know, I know it's possible. It's patently possible to live on less. But if Gen Z are getting a big pay rise, everyone else should as well. You know, I mean, the cost of living is astronomical, and the quality of life is sort of, you know, it's a war of attrition, I think, and it makes people angry, and fair enough.
Yeah. I remember sometimes I like to go out into town and into the world and ask people, like, how much does it cost to live in London? Or how much do you think you actually need to live comfortably in London? Don't ask why I do this. I'm just a weird person and I like to talk to people about money. I know that's not the norm. And actually, the numbers that you're hearing from every generational age are significantly higher than that £40,000. If you ask someone how much you think it costs to live comfortably in London, the numbers coming back are 70, 80, maybe £100,000 a year per person. So whilst this £40,000, I suppose, seems high, I suppose the argument that person who originally might have said it was £40,000 doesn't actually stretch you that far. It stretches you to a nice, moderate life. Sure. Probably with some levels of comfort, but we're not talking about levels of luxury here. We're not talking about, you know, flying private jets to like the Caribbean or anything like that. They're just asking for, I suppose, a simple lifestyle.
Yeah. I mean, rent, like not a palace, but like a little flat. We're talking about London. These are very little flats for £1,000. I don't think it should be an outland, you know, that life, there's no reason life shouldn't include things we want as well as things we need. You know, I think that's not an unreasonable thing to ask from full-time employment either.
Yeah, this idea that if you are a full-time employee, you should have the ability to be able to save, put money towards your future self, go on a couple of holidays, maybe one holiday a year or something like that, eventually buy your own house. You know, things that aren't outrageous to say.
It's not crazy.
I mean, let's kind of like shift this a little bit and look at, I suppose, the mindset of someone that would say this. I'd love to know even your personal perspective. If I'm sitting there saying, you know, like I'm 21 years old, fresh out of uni, and I will not say yes to a job that doesn't pay me more than £40,000 a year. Are you looking at someone that's driven, quite ambitious, looking to get the best out of life? Or are you looking at someone who needs to, you know, suck it up and do their time?
Yeah, I guess asking someone to do their time is all very well when we didn't have to do it. You know, like we didn't have to work. Well, we worked for much less, but it got us a lot more, you know. If I was talking to a younger sibling and they didn't want to get out of bed for less than 40, I'd have to say in 2025, I'm afraid you're going to have to. But I'm sorry that means you're probably going to have to stay living with your parents for 10 more years than you'd like to. Or, you know, I'm sorry that means you're going to have to share with strangers in a part of the city you don't want to live in a way that I didn't and your parents didn't have to, you know, if they were in a similar situation. I guess, you know, driven, it's good to be ambitious, I suppose, you know, not for its own sake, but that's important too.
Ambition versus being realistic, I think, is the argument here. I think, you know, average salaries in the country being around that £35,000-£36,000 mark. I know it's a bit higher, it's over 40 in London, but 35, 36. So if you are sitting there at 21 saying that you're not going to get out of bed for 5k, unless it's 5k more than the average salary, you can start to see why people would get angrier. But I suppose that the annoying thing here, and what makes this an argument rather than just pure fact, is that people aren't looking at a table that goes average cost of living in the 1970s, the 1980s, the 1990s, the, you know, 2000s, 2010s versus average salary that used to be able to cover you, XYZ. If we had, you know, everyone was sat down in a nice classroom, sat in front of a whiteboard and shown, you know, yes, you earned £10,000 a year in 1962, but living cost you £3,000 a year, you were left with £7,000 worth of savings after all of that. Numbers purely made up for this totally. Case, I do want to say.
Houses cost this much and, you know, yeah, totally.
I suppose that is what's needed. The fact that we don't have that, we have ambiguity, and then we have the fact that, you know, life is a lot more expensive and salaries haven't gone up as fast as life has, but people don't see that. They don't see the disparity anymore. No. So I do understand, as let's say you're 70 or 80 years old, you look at the number of £40,000, you're like,
sure,
the £40,000 in my day would have been outrageous to earn. It's just about context, isn't it? And about trying to, you know, fit into the current time of life. So if people are saying these things like, I'm not going to get better for £40,000 a year, what should be done, or what needs to be done, I suppose, to get more people to be ambitious and want to get into the workforce? Is it just simply national living wages need to shoot up and shoot up quickly? Or is it an educational program to young people?
I mean, I'm sort of in favour of the more radical approach. I think, I mean, everyone should, tweak the wages up. I really think that would make a huge difference. Mm. And would, yeah, that's my answer. That's my policy.
It's the
Prime Minister.
You've just pretty got everyone under the age of 25 exactly. has just voted your way for a £40,000 starting salary, regardless of where you are in the country.
Yeah.
Just handing out checks left, right and centre. You wrote quite a lot about this article, didn't you? What was the reaction? What were some of the comments? What was the most amount of feedback that you got after writing this?
Well, a lot of Gen Z or a lot of younger people commenting saying, I don't recognise my generation in this caricature of, you know, this sort of this lazy, entitled caricature, which we've talked about a bit.
Yes.
Lots of older people who I think read the headline rather than the article, which is a classic. Feeling angry about how it compared to how things were in their day.
A lot of anger. Basically, no one agreeing with this one person that made this one comment.
Exactly.
And if someone was to kind of dive into that article, what was your general narrative on this comment?
I was arguing that that Gen Z or anyone, but Gen Z specifically in this case, asking for higher wages. It's a perfectly reasonable thing to do, considering the cost of living, I'm team Gen Z, even if they're only imaginary, or Graham Cowley's imaginary Gen Z.
Team, get your worth, and if you can,
sure. Well, life,
go for it.
Yeah.
No, which I think is absolutely right. I think this is a big lesson to people about reading headlines and assuming that a comment made by one person reflects an entire generation as well.
Mm.
Because both sides have an argument. If you take it purely in its factual sentence state, I get it, the anger. But it's more about the underlying comment, about what it meant and why that person was saying it in the first place. It's just about, it's hard to live right now.
Yeah.
Gen Z should push harder for higher wages.
Yeah,
simple
totally.
As.
And, you know, the older adults who are already established, it's also easy for them to say, it's easy to get by, much easier to get by on £40,000 if you're already set up, right? Like, if that's someone's wage in their 40s or 50s, they say, well, I'm all right. You say, yeah, well, sure, you managed to save up for a house in a totally different decade,
yes.
you know, and in a totally different economic landscape.
So, final question for you.
Yeah.
If you were the person making this comment, and I was going to take you back to time, and you got one chance to say it over, so you could, no one had heard it yet.
Yeah, okay.
And you had to say the words, I, as a Gen Z, wouldn't get out of bed for less than, what number would you insert there?
I think 40 is definitely is idealistic, but I think that's what's good about this conversation, is that it's productive because it gets people talking. So I think stick with 40. It's half your salary is going on the average rent, you know, it's just not big numbers,
and the rest on tax.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, the title isn't changing, people.
No, you heard it here
first. Stick to it.
Yep.
And deal with the consequences afterwards. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate you coming down.
Thanks.
And please continue to write about this kind of stuff, because it just gets conversations about money going, right?
Yeah,
that's
totally.
The important part.
Well, thanks so much.
Pleasure. Thanks. Well, there you go. That is a very interesting conversation about the world of £40,000 salaries. I wish I started on that much. I'm not going to lie. I should have fought harder for my starting salary. That was my main takeaway. But I hope people listening can understand. It's more about the sentiment. We're not still... I don't think Gen Z or people that are saying, I don't recognise caricature. What they will recognise is about, it's really tough right now and we need to fight for higher salaries. Doesn't mean I won't go and happily work for a lower salary. It's just about pushing for more to, I suppose, ease the stress. Because I think it's a pretty much factual thing to say. It is a really, really hard time to live and salaries are not going up as quickly as they should be. Anyway, it's time for your audience questions. Every week I give you the opportunity to DM me on Instagram. At That Money Show is the handle. It's a great handle because it's the exact name of the show. And you can send in your questions. And I try to answer one or two or three, as well as some on the live stream if people are watching. About the topic of money. And we've got a few that are coming in already and a few that have been sent in. So let's start off with the first one from Tom, who has said, hey, my partner and I have been saving for the past year with the goal of buying a house in the future. What are the first steps in being financially ready to buy a house? We have a joint savings account and have set up direct debits into the account. Is this enough or should we be doing more? Tom, let's kick off straight away with saying that you don't need to be pushing for £40,000 a year. But if you did get that, that would be a great first step. But in terms of your, I suppose, specific circumstances, the first steps to being financially ready to buying a house is to knowing how much you need to buy a property. So what I would, I suppose, recommend you is start to understand how much things cost, then how much of a deposit you might need. On average, around 10% or above is, I suppose, the starting point. Knowing where you want to live will help you understand the kind of property you want to buy. And that's a great first step to understand the goal that you need to reach. Now, of course, it's not also always only about your deposit. The mortgage that you need to borrow is also a massive factor and an element of that. So the next step, after you've kind of got a rough deposit in mind and you've set out a bit of a saving plan towards that deposit, is to go and speak to a mortgage advisor or a mortgage broker. You see, there's a lot of them that are free, literally free. They earn their money from, I suppose, getting the kind of commission once they've secured your rate. But a lot of them will speak to every single provider regardless. So they're going to give you the best deal possible, the good ones as well, the ones that come recommended to you. So it's never too early to speak to a mortgage advisor, especially if it's free. You can give them all of your specific circumstances and they will help you understand exactly where you need to get to start purchasing a property. They're going to ask you the right questions, start you get you to look into the right things about how much properties cost and how much you need to save and how much you need to earn. So that would really be my next step. Once they've given you that plan, it's simply about breaking it down into bite-sized and manageable steps. You need to save 10K over the next 10 months. You need to start putting away £1,000 a month. That's the kind of math you need to be doing alongside your partner. So that would be kind of my three-step plan. Number one, find exactly where you want to live and start understanding the property prices. Number two, maybe look at a deposit and how much you need to start and start building a plan towards that. And then number three, get online with a free mortgage advisor who will give you specifics of what you need to do. Next question, because it's coming from Helen. Thank you very much for sending in a question, Helen. Is, hi, I have a lot of expenses coming up over the next few months, and I know I'm going to need to spend more than what is in my account. Is it better for me to take a small loan, or should I just let my account go into overdraft? This is a bit of a tricky one, of course, because what you're saying here is you think or you believe you will need to go into debt. Debt is best to be avoided in all circumstances, which is, you know, you're needing to borrow money to cover expenses. So my first step to anyone in this position is, can you save or can you cut expenses to hopefully cover yourself down the line? But I'm assuming your answer here is going to be no. Like, there's just no way around me borrowing. So, like I said, never good to get into debt. But if you can get into debt, you need to do it in the smartest way possible. And then also on the other side of it, the moment you can, try and pay it off in full aggressively. Get out of that debt. Overdrafts are tricky. Unless you have an overdraft allowance, which a lot of student accounts have, but not a lot of adult accounts have, overdrafts can be tricky. They come with fees and really high, I suppose, costs and interest rates. So know exactly what that product is and the cost of having that product. A personal loan or a 0% potentially credit card could be the place that you want to look, because this is going to be where it's the cheapest for you to borrow that money. You kind of borrow it, especially if it's a 0% interest rate card. You might have 12 months or 24 months to pay it off. And so those are the products. So the way that you kind of want to think about it or look about it, and again, you need to do your own research and find the thing that sorts your own personal circumstances, is where is it cheapest for me to borrow that's going to put me under the least amount of pressure and that I know I'm going to be able to pay off in full. Look at all of your options, compare them side by side, look at the cost and also all the terms and conditions, and that's the best way to kind of go about it. But again, only borrow what you need. Don't borrow too much. Only borrow exactly what you need and try and set a really clear repayment plan. Again, look into this. Your own circumstances are always going to be best. This isn't financial advice. This is just kind of a mathematical approach to the problem. And the final question, I'm going to try and squeeze it in. What are the problems with compound interest? Because it sounds too good to be true. Compound interest, there are no problems. It's a mathematical thing. If you invest a little bit of amount and you get a certain interest rate percentage, it's a math. Compound interest isn't the problem. People's perceptions around investing is the problem. Cool. That is all we have time for on the show. So I want to say a quick thank you to Jake Moore, the Global Cybersecurity Advisor, and our journalist, Emily Watkins, for coming onto the show today. Thank you to everyone that listened. Remember, you can download the FUBAR Radio app and listen to us live every single week, or you can listen back on any podcasting platform or find us on all socials under @ThatMoneyShow. So remember, do check us out. Send in some questions. I have been That Money Guy. This has been That Money Show. And as promised about an hour ago, you are now officially better with your money.
FUBAR Radio.